Acaba de presentar isto.
Muy bien, pues boas tardes e grazas pola vosa presenza. Compráceme pois presentar na sesión do seminario Sentidos da Cultura ao profesor William Shee, tanto pola súa trayectoria, tratándose como é pois un especialista na historia da ciencia, o máximo especialista internacional en Galileo, aínda que ten máis dos libros ben coñecidos sobre Galileo, diversas obras sobre Pascal, por exemplo, ou Descartes, tamén polo propio tema que vai abordar, que un tema que se foi aparecendo en algúns dos debates mantidos até agora sobre diversas dimensións da cultura, e nomeadamente no debate que tivemos sobre a ciencia contemporánea, o seu impacto na cultura, que é precisamente as relacións entre religión e ciencia. Ninguén máis autorizado que pois, para cubrir este oco, este valeiro que viñamos mantendo e que aparecera, mesmo tiña compromiso de algún dos asistentes regulares ao seminario, de abordar sustantivamente e introducir unha sesión dedicada a este particular. Pola miña parte, máis nada, si aproveitar, porque houve un cambio de datas no seminario, tedes canda o texto en galego da ciencia a religión de William Shee, tedes un solto no que se comunica a data definitiva o xoves 17 de xuño para a seguinte intervención no seminario, esta sesión de Isabel Pires de Lima, da Cultura e Novo Mundo Novo. O texto tamén está xa disponible na rede, ainda que o día do seminario, como sempre, entregaremos unha versión traducida ao galego por escrito. E por a miña parte, máis nada, que agradecer o esforzo do profesor Shee de que hoxe nos acompañe. Como sempre, para as que non adoitan asistir ao seminario, faremos a exposición durante 50, 60 minutos. A continuación faremos unha pausa para o café e retomaremos para o debate a continuación. Por lo tanto, moitas gracias, profesor Shee.
Vamos preguntar. Dinos se preferimos a exposición en inglés ou en italiano.
Houve algunhas demandas.
Está o texto en galego aí?
En francés.
No, en inglés ou italiano. Querido, en inglés, podes ser en inglés?
En inglés.
Very much for the presentation. If I speak too fast, please stop me. I'm very grateful for your invitation, and I am in complete admiration for two things. The first one is that you are here on such a beautiful day, which means the dedication to culture is greater than the enjoyment of such a beautiful weather that we've been having since we arrived 3 days ago. And the second thing, I apologize, what I sent out was a discussion paper, but I hadn't realized how efficient the Consilio is, and it's already been printed. But I will send you after the discussion. I like to revise and put the notes after the discussion, because I always learn something from the discussion. And so the idea of Galileo and the reception of his discoveries by the church is something a bit curious has been happening. Well, many curious things have been happening. One of them, of course, is that now I understand why everyone wants to come to Santiago de Compostela. But there is a renewal of interest in the relationship between science and religion, which were considered from the Enlightenment onward and by many people, especially around 1850, as incompatible views. Science having superseded, I'm sorry, I'm having problem with technology.
Sorry about that. Wait a minute, please. Teresa, apuñaremos mellor este micro. Cambiamos o micro. Sí. No.
Or am I
it's
loud
fine,
enough
fine.
Without the micro?
I think it's fine.
Okay, lovely. Thank you. That the interpretation of the world had been completely superseded by the rise of modern science. Now this is this view, of course, has been greatly modified. And what is happening now, for two reasons, I think the debate on science and religion has been transformed and rendered more interesting. One is that there is an interesting historical issue in what really did happen. What was the contribution of the church to science, or what were the obstacles that the church set up to science? The second one, I think, is more open to debate, is the fact that we have cultural tensions. What is the identity of Europe, or the identity of countries that have a deeply embedded a Christian vision of the world? On the one hand, we are anxious to be as international, as all-encompassing, as cooperative as possible, but we must admit that fundamentalism is also on the rise. I'm not only thinking of the sad fundamentalism that is of the terrorist nature, but I was lecturing in the Middle East in a university created by one of the Seven Emirates, and the Sheikh Al-Khatimi, who has founded the university, had no problems with fundamentalism until the Americans invaded Iraq, and now he has problems. If we take our case, I suppose most of us are inside the Christian tradition in some sense or other. The fact that fundamentalist movements inside the church are also the case. Friends of mine who teach in the seminaries are finding that the seminarians are less willing to entertain real problems and find it more comfortable sometimes to go back to a more fundamentalist type culture. At a time when society is interested in perhaps not institutionalized religion, but in spirituality. Last week in Venice, I met a distinguished American scientist who said to me, did the pilgrimage to Santiago de Compostela last year, and it was the greatest experience of my life. Really transformed my personal life. And this man does not believe in God. And at a dinner in Bologna a short while ago, the daughter, who was doing a doctorate in history of science, and certainly comes from a Jewish family, non-practicing, she also did this and told me it was a fundamental experience for her. So these numbers of people are increasing, and so they create a different atmosphere. So the general idea that I have working on Galileo is when I give a talk to a lay audience, I know what everyone thinks of Galileo, because everyone has seen Brecht's play. Brecht was an extremely gifted dramatist, and he wrote this play that is translated in all languages. And he uses a very clever device. I mention this because when you write your play on whatever, do use it. It's extremely devastating for the rest of us. Not during the play, of course, but in the printed text, he puts down 10 September 1609. And to my astonishment, because he gives a precise date, people believe this is historical. You know, it's very interesting in the academic world, because we write our little articles for the five or six people who read us, or when we're applying for grants and so on. But that is the vision of the world. And so at the end, very frequently, almost invariably, some asks me, but what you have said does not seem to tally with what we saw in this play. So it's a fascinating psychological experience, and I'm not very good at handling this sometimes. So I prepared a number of slides so we can see some of the things, because the visual background is important. Galileo is born in 1564, and I belong to the historical school And I think it's absolutely useless to learn one date for one person. But if there are two, then I'm willing to do it. If there are three, it's even more fun. So Galileo was born in 1564. Shakespeare is born in that year. And Michelangelo dies in that year. So it's a frame of reference, isn't it? It's also comes after the Council of Trent, which another legend would have us believe that it led to a great reform. It led to a great shake-up, but religious reform is a problematic. He died in 1642. That's a date I only learned because it's the year that Newton was born. So we see the framework. He is before Newton, and he will provide Newton with elements of his synthesis. Galileo is a professor at the University of Padua, where he arrives in 1592. The whole university, all the professors, would sit comfortably in this room. There were exactly 38. You had the Faculty of Law, by far the most important one, were in the majority. They were approximately 17, more or less. And then the other faculty, which is called Artium, are not the Artium in our sense, because the most important part are students of medicine. One nice feature of the theology in those days is you could go in as a student, and at 9 o'clock, which is the most important period, the Queen of Sciences had that slot. And you could, as a student, go to listen to the Dominicans and have Theologia ad mentem sancti tome, or you could go and listen to the Franciscan ad mentem scoti. Very interesting in a way, because it provoked a certain amount of dialogue and discussion. Galileo was out of the 28 in the Faculty of Arts. They were numbered. And sometimes I think it's important because I have friends who are bishops, and I think that, like former colleagues of ours who become ministers in the government, or former colleagues who become priests, they sometimes get a view of themselves that's somewhat exalted. So it's good to remember that there's a human dimension. Galileo is number 27 out of 28 because he's teaching a very minor subject called mathematics and astronomy, and all the science. Now, how important is this notion is the following. There is a contest between the professor number 28, who is teaching, I'm sorry to have to say that's philology, is actually teaching Latin and Greek, and the Jesuits, who have good schools, arrive, and they start teaching Latin and Greek to the younger students, which, in a sense, which should be good for him, but he protests for this. And he wants to get rid of the Jesuits. And for 10 years, he publishes against the Jesuits. He insults them. Finally, the bishop, a man called Cornaro, goes and sees this professor and says, look, at the beginning of the academic year, there's a procession from the cathedral. And you come in your rank. You know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and Galileo is 27. And this guy says, if you will agree to put an end to this quarrel with the Jesuits, next year you can be the first to enter. Now, this man has been fighting the Jesuits for 10 years. As soon as the bishop does that, he signs. I'm mentioning some of these psychological factors which tell us sometimes to understand a world that has changed in very many dramatic ways. But what does to us sounds quite foolish. So Galileo is really no one. He is teaching students who are not in philosophy. He is teaching students, 95% are scientists because they're studying medicine. This is the time when William Harvey is there. William Harvey will discover the circulation of the blood. And there are a number of very good people. Why do they go and study with Galileo and take his course? Well, today you see a doctor in says, oh, well, you know, you might have this or that or the other, but before I can do anything, we have to take your pressure. You have to have an echogram or whatever. You have to have all these tests, and after that, you come and see me. So you go and you go through all these machineries, and you have this lengthy report about your cholesterol and glycemia and so on. Okay. In those days, they did the same thing, but in a different version. It's before you had a patient come in, you say, well, I don't know if I can do something right now, but before we do anything, I need your horoscope. And now, the doctor made the horoscope, so he had to acquire from Galileo the skills to make this horoscope. And you know, this work, the way it works for us, you give your test to the doctor and he says, ah, it's not as bad as I thought. You're almost on the limit of, you know, pressure. And the people would say, well, if we wait until next month, Mars and Venus will be in a conjunction that is favorable to you. And so you go home and say, tell your wife, how was it? And you say, oh, it's not too bad, because the next month. So that's the real context of this man Galileo. What happens is that he teaches elementary astronomy. He's a brilliant, extremely gifted mathematician. And he hears that a telescope has been made. The telescope had been made, we're now in 1609. Telescopes existed for at least 10 years, but they were made with lenses that enable you to increase the size about four times. I've seen some of these. Galileo is a lucky man because he has friends in Murano where they make lenses. And economic historians in the last 10 years have made a sensational discovery. I was just delighted today when I went to the archives across the street to see that the person who does the archives is putting on the computer all the business transactions. I mean, you have a mine here. It's fabulous what you have in Santiago. It will certainly be a major contribution that will be possible thanks to the work that you're doing here. Anyhow, they found out that from 1250 onwards, even before the arrival of the Turks, they were selling to Constantinople and then to Istanbul something like 10,000 lenses like this per year. Now, we didn't know that. But now art historians, I mean, every day an art historian will say that he's found yet another picture. And they are, of course, fairly large number of representations from 1250 onwards. But they were of no interest. So when something's of no interest, you don't look at it. And that's the way things are. So Galileo makes his telescope. It enlarges objects 10 times. Now, that's a very important thing. I mean, if I see Cecilia here, who comes from Padua, and I see her across the street, and I see you know, four times bigger, I'm not going to see very much. But if I'm a university student and I'm in one of the residences, and at the other end there's a girl in another residence, and it can magnify 10 times, then it becomes very significant. 10 times really gives you results that are positive. So Galileo trained his telescope, and we will see what he saw. This is what he saw. On the right-hand side, magnification of 15, he reached that, and we see on the right hand a photograph made by a modern telescope that increases almost 20 times. So we're very, very close to the magnification. Now, if you look at this, you say, well, I'm going to take Galileo's telescope, which I had one made. Fortunate if a Murano man by the name of Seguso made a perfect replica. I mean, actually, it's the same family. They were there 400 years, continuous work on this. Well, Galileo could not see this because the field of vision, and the field of vision means what you see with a telescope. If you have a telescope, you look at the moon and you can see the moon. But he could only see one quarter of it. Because the field of vision, so he has the one quarter, one quarter, one quarter, one quarter. And because it's important for him when he will publish his little book, that people don't think it's as easy, he never mentions that. So people would pick up this telescope, you know, and it takes a little bit of time to realize that you have to move it like that and you have to put it on a stand and so on. So that's good. I would like you to think this seems to be very simple. What is important about this painting is that you see that the line that goes, you have the illuminated part on the right, it's the crescent moon, and you see that the line between the bright and the dark part is discontinuous. For us, a clear indication that it goes over mountains and so on. But also, if you look inside, do you have a... I'm sorry, I should have that. It's not important, please. Galileo realized that these mountains are peaks of mountains being illuminated. Now, when you see this, I mean, first thing I want to say in the context is I still have to say, you know, why did the church refuse to accept this evidence? Well, the church did not refuse. I mean, no one in his right mind refused that. It was an instant success. And I know it's an instant success because they doubled his salary. That is the most significant, clear evidence that it worked. So, and what is amazing here is that Galileo, he said that constantly throughout his life. He did not want to become a university professor. He wanted an interesting and exciting life. So, he wanted to become a painter. And his father, who was a musician, said to him, look, you know, we're poor. They were from a good family that had gone down. From living in Florence, they had to sell their house. They went and lived in the countryside. Then he married a lady who was from the merchant class and so on. So he said, look, you will never, you know, be able. You're good at mathematics, and why don't you get yourself a safe job, become a teacher? Reluctantly, Galileo did that, and he wrote papers that are technical and very, very brilliant paper, and he got himself a job. But all his life, all his friends, by the way, he has few friends in the university. His friends tend to be artists and mainly painters. That's the community, you know, when you want to know what do people do. So I teach mathematics from 9 to 2 at the University of Santiago, and then my life begins. Galileo is a little bit like that. So his relationship with his colleagues has always been quite perilous, although there was one case, and we might mention that in the discussion, where he was helped by. And he had friends, many of his friends were priests, because the priests were often the educated members of community. So this is a second painting by Galileo. If you notice in the lower half, you have what we call a crater. And that crater is somewhat enlarged. You can see the shadows on the inside. And that is another way of proving that you have, as we see in the north, the mountains and then a crater. So this is the overwhelming evidence. It's accepted by everyone. And the second reason why it's accepted by everyone is that the Germans immediately plagiarized the book. But the Germans did not have the engravings. And the engravings and the plagiarized, they had the text, but they couldn't, you know, if you look at the German edition, you see that it's, well, they didn't pull it off. Okay, that's just the other side, too. So 15 days later, you confirm what you did. And I made a photograph here, and you can see that the crater in Galileo's is much bigger. So a question I sometimes get is that Galileo was cheating. There are some professors here. A professor always cheats a little. You know? we in order to explain, we have to... We say, look, I mean, the law of free fall works, okay? And then people make a test and they say that there's air resistance. And so, oh, forget about that. It's in the vacuum. Oh, yeah. Oversimplification, okay. Now, Galileo had a problem because when you make this engraving, it's very difficult to make anything as small as that. So I think it's merely intelligent what he did. So now, this is something interesting to me and enter into his views, because his views are the views of the man who will be his opponent, Urban VIII. This is the moon as he sees it. And on the same sheet of paper in the bottom, my apologies, you see something. Who recognizes that? Now, look, I don't believe in astrology because I'm a professor at university. But this morning, when I opened up one of the many newspapers in the hotel, I immediately went to my horoscope. And I read there that today would be a very beautiful day. I would see in the morning a friend. I met Philippe. And in the afternoon, I would have an enjoyable time meeting other people. And all this has been confirmed. So my horoscope has been confirmed. Galileo had been the teacher of the Cosimo II. This is the horoscope of the Grand Duke. That's applied science. I make a discovery. And this is true. You know, go to a grant and say, Professor, this people, you know, from Santiago are applying for a grant. What is going to be the payoff? What are going to be the applications? So being very clever in Santiago, they always find something. But this is what Galileo is doing. I mean, it's not, for us, it's not a success. But you can see the frame of mind in which he is operating. The other point, and here I'm coming to the religious vision of Galileo, it's very difficult to know what people really profoundly believe. I mean, I think sometimes we don't even know what we believe ourselves. I mean, Galileo believed that God had called him, almost in a prophetic sense, to make the celestial discoveries. The first time I saw that in an official document, I said, it's just the rhetoric. And everyone interpreted this rhetoric. The second time, I found it in a personal letter. And I said, well. The third time, I found it in a book that he owned personally, and he wrote in the margin. And then I found it again in part of what was his diary. He was deeply convinced. I mean, it's a strange belief also. I mean, I'm crazy, but not to that point. thinking that God is really... And he was incensed because a Jesuit, two Jesuits made other discoveries independently. He could not believe that this was true. I mean, he didn't really examine the evidence. He knew that this was not the case. So it's an extraordinary subjective belief. And Galileo did not read books when he was not quoted. Many professors do that to the present day, But for a very interesting reason, his view was excellent. I mean, if someone reads a book, I ask them what is interesting in it. Why should I read a book? You read a book and you say, well, that chapter is interesting, the rest is not. So here's a question that we can ask William Gilbert, the famous book on magnetism published in 1600. Galileo bought that book when it came out and he did all the experiments with a friend of his called Sagredo. For 1 year, they just went through the book and did all the experiments on magnetism. Well, Gilbert looked at the moon through an empty tube. I don't know if you still have this tradition in San Diego. At the beginning of January, we used to, before the computer, receive 10 calendars, arriving in a nice tube. I used to say to my students, well, this tube is you take out the calendar, you throw it away, and keep the tube. Because we're going to make an experiment. If you look at the stars right now today and through an empty tube that is long, you see the stars or from a well. So this is what he did. And a curious thing, this was only published posthumously. If you look, sometimes we are told that the Americans put a flag on the moon. But the English did that well ahead of time. You can see this here. Britannia. So this led me to start looking at people who believe that there were inhabitants of the moon. Well, you know, when you start looking for something, you find it. And a surprising number, where does it come from? It comes from Plutarch, De facie lunae, you know, the face of the moon. Now, this is so important at the time, there is a translation from the Greek into the Latin. You now have translations in French, German, Italian. But Kepler, who is a towering figure, Kepler is a genius. Kepler thinks this is so important that he makes his own Latin translation from the Greek, and then he writes a book on it, on the inhabitants of the moon. So, you know, to think of that was a perfectly natural thing. Now, he was not the first one to discover this. This is something the English are very proud of, but the significance. Thomas Harriot is an eccentric person who has a telescope that magnifies six times. Galileo observed in August 1609. Harriot observed on the 26th of July. You see, he's looking at the moon. I've turned it around so you could see it, but in the corner, the only thing he wrote, I don't know if you can see 1609, 26 July. He dated it. No comment whatsoever. But he sees that the line is discontinuous. But because he is not asking himself whether the moon is like the Earth, he doesn't make the discovery. What happens, though, when the book written by Galileo, the Sidereus Nuncius, appears on March 13, 1610, in those days, ambassadors were really important people. Now ambassadors don't count very much because, I mean, if Mr. Zapatero wants to speak to Mr. Berlusconi, they do it on a so-called protected telephone line. So the ambassadors have another role. I mean, interesting, but in those days they had a very interesting role, was to provide information. The day this book is published, the British ambassador, and I know the German one also, but the British ambassador, gets a copy and sends it off to England. You know, that was their job. You get off. Imagine, wouldn't that be nice? I mean, you know, when Filippi's book comes out and you have all the ambassadors in Madrid sort of waiting at the bookshop. So the book reaches Harriet, who is a very influential person. Harriet looks at the book, and then he looks at the moon again. And what does he see? You see that crater in the center? You see what you expect to see. Now, that's why I think objectivity is a very interesting and ambiguous term. You see what you expect to see. You see, he saw the book. And having seen the book by Galileo, he had different observations. I just want to go on showing rapidly the church on this. Here we have a series of Jesuits who have undoubtedly the best schools. There's a book written by John Heilbronn in which he demonstrates that the best schools are the Jesuit schools. It's a nice thing. John Heilbronn is the former chancellor of the University of California in Berkeley, and he is not only is not a Catholic, he's not a Christian, he's nothing. I mean, so it's more objective evidence, I suppose, in a sense, you could say. So the Shiner has a telescope that is inferior to Galileo. He agrees with what Galileo says. But you see, he's not, this is my hypothesis, he is not an artist. I have tried, I'm not an artist either. And when I look at the moon, you look at the moon, and then you put down your telescope, or you push it aside, and I try to draw it. It's incredibly bad. You know, and I've been doing this for a long time. I just gave up. But most people have a very hard time drawing the moon after an observation. You have to really have gifts as a caricaturist or a designer. Shiner has no problem at all with the Jesuits in doing this. Matter of fact, I have several, in order to abridge this talk, I have five or six Jesuits. This is Bori. The reason I chose him is 1627. It's because it's Coimbra, and I suppose it's part of the part of the world that is under Galician influence. So Coimbra, 1627, a man called Bori, another Jesuit. Notice 1610, Galileo publishes. And then I could give you a whole series, 1627. And you say, look, it's been 17 years. Can't these people learn to draw the moon? I mean, they have telescopes that are as good as Galileo. Yeah, that's a question that I asked. And then I went on in time and I came to this. Claude Melun, 1637, 27 years. Now, who is Claude Melun? A scientist, a mathematician, an astronomer? Absolutely not. He is a very good painter. And he happens to have as a friend a man called Peiresque, Fabry de Peiresque, and more important, Gassin or Gassendi, well known to philosophers, a contemporary of Descartes. And they are together in the south of France near Marseille, and Gassendi tries to draw it and can't draw it very well. And then Fabry de Peres tries drawing it. And they say, well, why not ask Claude? Yeah, we have dinner with him once a month. So they bring in Claude and they say, look, Claude, would you mind looking at the moon? Oh, no, looked at it. He said, look, you look at the moon. And this is what he did. Within a month, Melun had reached this extremely high level. You know, what an astonishing example of interdisciplinarity. I mean, how terrible it is when you live your own mathematician only means mathematician, physicists only mean physicists. Theologians don't talk to each other, they just talk to God. You know, this is a marvelous instance, I think, where there was a shift in the vision, but in this case, the material possibility of doing it. Now, here's an instance of Caravaggio, 1597, the Church of San Luigi dei Francesi. That's 11 years before Galileo uses his telescope. Just watch at this. I'm very proud of my arrow. What does this man wearing? What a lot of people have, their glasses, their lenses. And these are the two types, concave. This is how Galileo was able to get them. They were not a rarity. And I'm not going to show you this today. They had many of these before. Okay, so what about the dissemination of Galileo's ideas? Well, I return to the most influential group in the church at that time, the Jesuit. Adam Charles von Bell is a Jesuit missionary who goes to China and has Galileo's Sidereus Nuncius translated into Chinese. My knowledge of Chinese is not minimal, but non-existent. So I am not. So the first thing I did when I got this book, I went to someone who read the Chinese. I didn't tell them what I was doing. I said, you know, this is a text that seems to be circulating in Chinese. Would you read it? And he read it. It's a short work. You know, he didn't read everything, but he read at least 10 pages. He says, excellent translation, just fine. But there's something curious about the artistic. You see, he has the man who translated, but then in the diagram, this is done by the Chinese, he has the crater put at the top. I won't go into this today, but it's much more difficult than we assume. When you read the text and you're not prepared, it could be an accident, but could also be that the engraver, who was not the translator, you know, you're paid to do that, and unless you discuss, there it is. We have this anomaly in what is said to be a very good translation. Now, here more interestingly is a relationship with the church. So, Galileo, as I said, wanted to become a painter. It's too late for all of us. I think all of us, it's too late. When we go to school, we should always choose our classmates very carefully. And Galileo went to art school, Scuola del Disegno, with an artist, his artist friends, and one of them, became, today is virtually forgotten, but he became one of the prominent painters in Rome. And Galileo sent him his Sidereus Nuncius, and he did not send him a telescope. Wasn't he a mean man, Galileo, not giving his best friend a telescope? Well, Galileo made his telescopes empirically. He never understood how the telescope works, something we learn when we're, I mean, we forget, but we learn when we're in 12 or 13 in high school. So he just took one convex and one in a tube, like our, maybe they had calendars in those days, that's why he had many tubes, and he would just fiddle around with them until he could see the moon or any other object. And out of 100 lenses, he would succeed with not more than 10. You know, it was empirical. Now, he always gave on that he knew el segreto. When he went back to Florence, he had a friend in by the name of Sagredo, who sends him a letter, "Dear Galileo, how are you? How are things in Florence?" Where he went back to be astronomer of the Grand Duke. You know, remember when you left, you told me that you would explain to me how to make the telescope, because we would like to make some. And Galileo replies, "Well, you know, I'd like to explain to you, but you know, I'm so busy here. You know, now that I'm here, I waste so much. I mean, I have to go to the dinners. Every time the Grand Duke has a dinner, I have to go there. And I really don't have time." But Venetians to the present day are very, very interesting. There are not many Venetians left, but they're usually very patient people. So a year later, Sagredo writes again and says, "Well, I hope that now you have your, I know that you have your house and so on, and I hope things are proceeding smoothly and you're not wasting so much time. So could you explain?" Fortunately, we have the letter by Galileo. And Galileo replies, "Well, I would like to explain this to you, but I would have to be with you to show you. So it can't be put in words." And that was the end of it. So it was a way of getting, I suppose he hoped one day to discover. If he had read Kepler, the dioptrics, you know, Kepler is a very paradoxical writer, because in many of his works, he tells you the whole history of what happened to him. If he was working out on a mathematical formula and he made 49 mistakes, He writes down the 49 mistakes that he then is. "I got it wrong, then I tried this and I got it wrong, then I tried this and I got it." I mean, it, you know, unless you're an historian of mathematics, it's not very interesting. Because today we're accustomed to the great fraud is the scientific article. A scientist who's making experiments, or a biologist, is not going to tell you that it took him 6 years to finally knock a DNA out of one of the viruses and put one in. He will just give you a short article in Nature saying we succeeded in, you know, modifying the DNA in this particular strand. But in this case, in the dioptrics, by rule of exception, Kepler is perfectly lucid. So poor Galileo missed out on that. Well, anyhow, Cigoli made himself a telescope, looked at the moon and saw that it had bumps and dents, and he was commissioned at that time by Pope Paul V. The Pope of Rome was also the King of Rome. More King of Rome than Pope. I mean, there's no doubt that when you say that the Council of Trent changed things, that is not true. I mean, I don't say that. I just read recently a book by a Jesuit who makes it quite clear. Council of Trent and all that. It's a marvelous sort of little book. Which is important. So, he's a Cortese, Borghese. If you've been to Rome, you may have been to the Villa Borghese, which was built by his nephew. When he became Pope, the popes would invariably enrich their family. Nepotism comes from that period. So his sister had married someone whose name was not Borghese. It'll come back to me in a moment. Another Roman family. So he tells his nephew, he says, from now on, you're going to be called Borghese, and you know, I'll make you a cardinal, and you can never be what you want. And Cardinal Borghese was interested in prestige of the Pope. So this is in Santa Maria Maggiore, one of the four major churches in Rome, and it's still there. I was there last month, so unless the terrorists have been there, they're still there. A chapel, if you enter Santa Maria Maggiore, which is probably well known in Spain because the ceiling was gilded with the first gold that came to Spain and was donated by the Catholic kings to Rome to make the ceiling of this, to decorate the ceiling. So on the left-hand side, there's a chapel, which is called Cappella Borghese, and the Pope and his nephew were anxious that this would really be their chance to display that they had the best painters, they had the best marbles, they had the best tombs, and so on. So he's commissioned, Cigoli is commissioned to do the ceiling, and this is what he does. I apologize for the quality. You see, if you look at the moon, traditionally in the iconography, the Virgin Mary is on a perfectly spherical moon. I mean, that is a symbol that that is eloquent. You know, I mean, you say the Blessed Mother with her foot on a pile of dust is, you know, if there had been any opposition to this, no. Cigoli put that, and the Pope was just delighted. I mean, from his point of view, this is an important asset. I mean, he was just so happy that everyone would know that he, Pius V, was the man who was, you know, at the front of scientific developments. So it's the church, yes, I mean, he was the Pope, and he actually told Galileo in a conversation that he didn't have to worry as long as he was Pope. I mean, he said that explicitly. You know, this is really great stuff. If I go on and see what happens, so what do you do find in Spain? Diego Velázquez. Velázquez was in Rome at the same time as Galileo in 1616. He had as a patron Del Monte, Cardinal Del Monte, who was a personal friend of Galileo. So we don't know if they met because we do not have the records of the parties, the dinner parties. The ambassador were really there to establish contacts, and one of their jobs was to have regular prestigious dinner parties. So Velázquez actually, we don't know if he met Galileo, but he certainly knew of Galileo's achievements because he was in the same context. Now he does something interesting. Velázquez is a man with greater religious interest, and he wants to make the Immaculada. That is the period, by the way, when the Spanish kings are telling the Pope, you have to make a dogma of this, Immaculate Conception. And the Pope says, well, it's all right if they want to believe that in Spain, but I don't believe it. So the Immaculate Conception, you know, this is one of the dogmas that's embarrassing because, you know, so many popes didn't believe in this until it was defined. And I think even Ratzinger might have problems with him. Yes. So you see what he does with the moon. He has an interesting compromise. I mean, he knows that the moon is not exactly like that. He doesn't want to give up the... I think this is what a great painter is able to do. He keeps something and pull another one. Okay. Now, a little bit later, 1619, look at how Francesco Pacheco uses it. He also knows the moon is not the moon of the traditional thing. And so he puts something inside because he doesn't want to sacrifice the symbolic value. At least this is my subjective interpretation. After a while, you will have, with Murillo, we go back to the traditional iconography because the other one. So this is, I think, what happens. The scientific discoveries, I mean, are interesting. But there's another dimension, which is the symbolic value of this. Now, as you see at this point, there is no no tension really between Galileo and the church. As a matter of fact, they're quite happy to have him. Galileo as how shall I say? Galileo is a perfect member of the church. He is a sinner, if I put it like that, without exaggeration. He doesn't go to Mass on Sunday. I don't know if it's because the preaching was so poor or the, I don't know. I think it's because he had taken a girlfriend, and that made his life a bit more difficult. So he was denounced to the Inquisition by his secretary. Galileo's relationship with his staff is not particularly successful. So there's this man who works for him for 18 months, and then he denounces him to the Inquisition. The Inquisition is always a highly local thing. It varies from town to town. In this case, in the Franciscan. So he comes in and he says, well, because of my conscience and because of my confessor. Who's your confessor? He's a Jesuit. The Franciscans are already know that they're not going to believe this. You have the war of factions. He says, yeah, I have to tell you that Galileo is casting horoscopes. What's wrong with that? He casts them with absolute certainty. I have heard him tell people that this is really not, you could say, well, it's probable. God could intervene. You always have to say God could intervene and so on. But no, absolute certainty. So the Inquisition, listen, we have the complete conversation. And the Inquisition just decide that this is absolutely of no interest at all. He's doing astrology, that's just fine. Everyone does it. So there is no condemnation at all. So it can't be the astrology, it can't be the telescope. It's 6 o'clock, and I would like to tell you later, after 6 o'clock, I'll just finish this section here very rapidly, and then we can have our coffee, for which you're all dying. Coffee is very good in Santiago. What Galileo did is, he also discovered that there were planets around Jupiter. That's the great sensation. First time since antiquity that some human being has discovered planets in the sky. And that's why he felt so strongly that God had given him this magnificent gift. And he worked out the periods. Now, the reason I do this is when I have sometimes a meeting, scientific councils, and I have all this blah, blah, blah about the new equipment we have, we're going to put, it won't cost us much, just €1 million, and we're going to have this telescope's going to do this, that, and the other. 1612, this is what Galileo determines the period. The planets, number one is the closest, number two is further out, number three spreading out in this. One day, 18 and a half hours. The other one, 3 days, 13 and a half, 7 days. Now, I said, what happened 300 years later? And I looked for something in 1912. I did not find it. I did not make an exhaustive. But I picked up the Encyclopedia Britannica in 1910. It said that thing was written a year before. It was one of the major editions of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Look at it. One day, 300 years of government investment in science, and look at the results. So it really is unbelievable, isn't it? Because you have fantastic telescopes later on, but Galileo had worked at this, and he managed. Okay, I know that no one here is applying for a grant in astronomy, so it's okay. Here is what Galileo saw about Saturn. What do you do when you make a discovery that Jupiter has satellites? Does Mars have satellites? It becomes your model. Jupiter has satellites? And he sees these are the rings of Jupiter, of Saturn, I beg your pardon. So he looks at Saturn and he tries to see on the right-hand side a satellite and on the left-hand side a satellite. And these things tend to appear and disappear. So he shows a sense of humor. He says, I was looking at Saturn's ears and then they have disappeared. So that was the only thing that he was unable to work out. It's a towering achievement what Galileo did, but Saturn's ears were there until Huygens, after Galileo's death, with a better telescope, explained. You see the tilts in the mass of matter that is spinning around in the rings of Saturn. Sometimes, if I put my hands like this, the and you are out there, you see it, but they tilt like that. Sometimes you don't see them because they tilt, and then they tilt down. So it's a periodic oscillation, and Galileo was unable to determine this. But that leaves us with the, then I'll introduce the discussion. I want to learn more about this from you after coffee. What happened, and why was Galileo condemned? And we have elements for that discussion.
Hacemos una pequeña pausa de 15 minutos para el café y volvemos luego para el café.